Most fundraisers know that women and childless couples are prime prospects for bequests and other estate gifts. New research suggests that those are still huge factors in the process, but timing your nonprofit's communication based on recency of gifts might be the exact wrong way to go. Russell James is a professor at Texas Tech University, where he runs the graduate program in charitable financial planning. In this episode, he dispels some myths and misconceptions when it comes to charitable estate gifts, based on his recent paper, The Emerging Potential of Longitudinal Empirical Research in Estate Planning, Examples from Charitable Bequests.
Welcome to Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times. We explore some of the most interesting and sometimes provocative findings focused on the world of nonprofits. Thanks for tuning in. Here at the Nonprofit Times, we see tons of great, fresh research. So in each episode, we take a recent study or survey and have a conversation with the authors about what they found and why they think it's important for charities. We'll also give away some books and give you access to other valuable information from the Nonprofit Times.
Let's start, I guess, with the title, The Emerging Potential of Longitudinal Empirical Research in Estate Planning, Examples from Charitable Bequests. That's a lot. What would you give a simpler title to for that if I'm a fundraiser flipping through the pages of this, or if I'm listening to the podcast?
Sure. Well, really the idea is we can know a whole lot more today than we used to be able to know. There's so much now that we can move beyond the realm of war stories, and we can actually say empirically what's going on when it comes to gifts and wills and trusts and how that changes during life and who actually makes those transfers and when those decisions change. So it's really about knowing a lot more about what happens with this charitable estate decision.
Mm-hmm. And is it because of the source of data that you mentioned in their paper? You cited a lot of times the health and retirement study. And I guess that's been around long enough now that you have a lot more data than you typically would, as opposed to, say, estate tax returns.
Yeah, exactly. And it is the case that, I mean, this may feel a little bit ghoulish, but the reality is the study itself started back in 1992. So we've got data every 2 years that's nationally representative, but we actually had to wait for enough study participants to die. Sure. Because the study actually tracks where everything went in their estate. So we can connect lifetime giving and other characteristics and planning with actual post-mortem transfers. And at this point, we've had over 14,000 people who've been in the study, which tracks them for their whole lives, starts as young as age 50, who have been in the study, who have passed away, and we can see where those estates have actually been transferred. And so that's very different than estate tax data, which is only really for the very wealthy right now. And of course, we don't have much in the way of any lifetime information about those people.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, because like estate tax returns would be literally those who were subject to the estate tax, which is now
yes.
Much bigger, much higher level than a higher cap after 2017, am I right?
Exactly.
It's like 22 million for a couple, yep. For instance.
Right.
So we'll call it the HRS, the Health and Retirement Study. The most recent year we're talking about now is what, like 2016?
Yeah, so it comes out every 2 years. We now have 2018 data that is available. And so when the article was written, the latest that we had, the final version of the data for was 2016. And at this point, we've got preliminary 2018 that we can start doing things with, but not in time for the publication of this article.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the time it takes to settle the estates and all that, the lag time?
Yeah, you know, there's that. And it's just, you know, it's actually a massive, massive study. Just to kind of give you a feel for it, the federal grant to the University of Michigan for this study is the largest federal grant in the history of the University of Michigan. It is a massive in-person study. Over 20,000 people involved. They come to the homes, they interview the people directly, and it covers all sorts of information on health topics, finances, insurance topics. But lucky for us, it includes charitable giving and charitable estate planning.
Wow, that is a lot. So I think generally our audience knows that folks without children, females, higher educated or more educated, I should say, folks with more wealth and income, they tend to be more likely to leave estate plans for charities in their will. Was there anything beyond the norm that you found as far as top line findings?
Yeah, you know, I would say that the things that you mentioned are true, and certainly probably among those things, the biggest surprise is the magnitude that childlessness changes things. I mean, it dominates all of the other characteristics. It's so important. But beyond this, there's something within those characteristics that's really important for charities that they're doing exactly the wrong way. And what I mean by that is this: what we see is that the charitable component of an estate plan becomes really fluid towards the end of life, the last 2 to 5 years prior to the end of life. We see a lot of the it just being completely removed, or people who didn't have a charity in before they added in. So we have all this fluidity taking place in the last 5 years of life. Now, here's the problem. The problem is the people who actually transfer dollars to charity at the end of life, those people, although if you go back, say, 10 years before they died, they were, most of them were donors, many of them were volunteers, but if you go to that last 2 to 5 years, the tendency to make any donations or to volunteer kind of falls off. And so what that means is you've got these charities that communicate with their older population based upon recency of donation. That's exactly the wrong way to communicate with this audience, because it turns out that they will stop giving right at that point when they're in that window of the last 2 to 5 years prior to death, when they're actually signing their final estate planning documents that actually control the dollars and very commonly have changes to the charitable component. So this is really important for charities and fundraisers to understand that if you have donors who are 70 plus, 80 plus, and you're communicating based on recency, you're guaranteed almost to be doing it exactly the wrong way when it comes to estate gifts. If they've had a long history with the organization, you need to keep communicating with them. Just stay in touch. Just stay in front of folks, even if they quit giving or volunteering, because that's actually the typical behavior of people who do transfer dollars to charity at death. This is a challenge for fundraisers, because what the data shows is essentially irrefutable. These decisions, the ones that actually control the dollars, they're made at very old ages. We're talking that, you know, over 75% of dollars transferred to charity are transferred by wills signed in the 80s, 90s, or older, okay? Now, I know that fundraisers don't want to hear that because it makes their job harder. They'd rather hear that I can just work with people my own age, we get in the will document, and then, you know, we can count it and forget it. And, you know, that can have other positive effects, but in terms of that will document being written in stone, we just see a whole lot of end-of-life fluidity, again, the last 3 to 5 years prior to the end of life, that controls these charitable estate planning components. So we need to stay connected to our oldest supporters and friends. Even if they stop giving and donating, we still need to stay kind of top of the mind.
We'll have more in a moment with Professor Russell James of Texas Tech about changing the donor mindset right after this.
If you like what you're hearing, share it with friends and colleagues on social media. Use the hashtag #FreshResearch or retweet the Nonprofit Times link, and you'll be eligible to win a book from the NPT Library. Another way for folks to find the show, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you love where you work? Do you think it's one of the best nonprofits to work for? Well, registration is now open through October for the annual Best Nonprofits to Work For, brought to you by the Nonprofit Times and Best Companies Group. The annual survey and awards program is dedicated to identifying and recognizing the best employers and providing organizations with valuable employee feedback. The study concludes in a top 50 list featured in the April edition of the Nonprofit Times. Find out more at bestnonprofitstoworkfor.com. Here's Russell James with more insights on donors and charitable estate gifts.
The paper also looked at the propensity for gifts of $1,000 or more around when they make those decisions. Can you talk a little bit about what you found there?
Yeah, certainly. So what we wanted to look at is, does a person's charitable giving look different before they added the charitable component as compared to after they added the charitable component? Now, understand this is not looking at people who don't have a charitable component, people who do. Okay, we're not interested in that. We're interested in the same human being. Did they behave differently after they added charity in the will document? And it turns out that they do. So for example, the propensity for a person to give at least $1,000 a year to charity goes from about 51% to about 61%. Now, that may not seem like a huge jump, but it actually is in this national level data, especially because these tend to be done at an age when the propensity to give normally starts going down. Propensity to make gifts to charity goes up with age until right around age 75, and then it drops each year with age. But we see this countervailing effect that if we have a person who includes charity in the will document, their propensity to make these gifts of $1,000 or more actually goes up significantly after they have done that.
How much does it go up, and how long does that last? Was there a certain number of years that continues?
Yeah, so there's two different ways to look at it. You can look at it in terms of propensity or in terms of amount. If we just look at the raw dollars, the average dollars worth of giving goes up about 77%. That is, in the years after, and this is all inflation adjusted, of course, in the years after they add charity to the estate plan, their giving is about 77% higher than it is in the years before. So just to kind of give you a sense for that, it goes from about $4,300 to about $7,700 on average. Now, that's one way to look at things, the 77% bump before versus after. But sometimes those bumps can be driven by a few very large donors, right? And so that's why we also look at propensity, whether or not in total they've been giving at least $1,000 a year to charity. And we also see that bump in terms of the propensity to give at least $1,000 a year to charity goes from about 51% to about 62%. So the only reason we look at it both ways is to show that this is a true sort of widespread behavioral change, that this huge bump we get in average giving, which is a 77% bump, that this isn't just driven by one or two folks, that this is kind of a across the board, we see this change. Now, the analysis that we looked at here showed that the effect lasted at least through 8 years. So the survey is done every 2 years. So we can see it 2 years after the change, 4 years, 6 years, and 8 years after the change. And also we compare that with 2, 4, 6, and 8 years before they added that charitable component. So there is this really big bump that happens in current charitable giving after the after charity is added to an estate plan, and it stays high. Now we've only tracked it through 8 years. If we get beyond that, then we get a smaller number of observations, so it's hard to be confident in those results. But very strong bump, very consistent across those following 8 years, that the current giving is much higher.
If you know a donor has made the change in their will to include charity, would it be fair to assume maybe to get a couple more asks in there in the couple of years after knowing that, or is that not connected enough?
Yeah, you know, I think what's likely happening here is that you're actually getting a change in the donor mindset, that it's not relating to a change in fundraiser behavior. It's more a change in the way that the donor thinks about things. And let me give you some plausible explanations for what's happening here in terms of mindset. You know, one idea is that this, for many donors, is the first time they've ever thought about or actually committed to giving out of wealth, rather than just giving out of disposable income. And whenever you can change that donor mindset from giving out of pocket change, you know, disposable income, where they compare it to what they just spent at Starbucks. And you start getting them to think about giving out of wealth, where they're comparing their giving with their total wealth and ownership. That can be transformational. And so it's possible that's what's happening here is their point of reference has changed. You know, another way, more simply, is they could just think, well, look, this is already going to go to the charity. Why don't I just give some of it now so I can actually have the fun of seeing the impact, you know? Mm-hmm. So maybe the mindset changes in that frame. You know, and maybe there's something to be said with just the idea that, boy, once a donor puts you in the will, they're treating you like a family member, right? They're treating you like a child. And that kind of connection, that identification with the charity is probably going to be expressed in a lot of other ways, including more current giving.
Were there any other kind of statistics nuggets in there that people should know about, as far as just any kind of new information on the percentage of folks who have a will or what average age, that kind of stuff that is typical, or anything that was kind of an outlier or changed over time?
You know, one of the things I'd like to point out that I found interesting, and this is now the third in a series of publications that coming from different sources of information that each sort of confirm this story, and that is when it comes to charitable estate planning among minorities. And what we see here is a consistent story. It's a story that shows that there is not a barrier of philanthropic intent, there's actually a documentation barrier. So for example, if we look at propensity to have a charitable estate plan, it's actually much lower among minorities. But if you only look at people who have the documents, then it's not lower. In fact, in many ways, it's higher than you would expect given wealth and income disparities. So we've actually got this documentation barrier that is a real issue with minority communities. And in fact, there's some other research where people are asked about, and it's nationally representative, where they're asked about their interest in leaving a gift to a charity. And minorities actually score much higher on that willingness, that interest, but they just don't have the documents. Of course, this is nothing that is new when it comes to all sorts of legal services and financial services. There is this gap where minorities don't have the same connection with those financial and legal services. And so it's something to keep in mind for fundraisers, because it's really an untapped area where you've got this community that is very charitable, but they just don't have the documents. And so if we can overcome that documentation barrier, then it allows individuals to be able to express their philanthropic desires in a way that, they're just not doing right now because they don't have the documents that are necessary in order to express those.
Yeah, so really it sounds like almost just technically getting them the documents to make them aware of it.
Absolutely. Just getting the planning done is the real barrier there. Not developing some sort of philanthropic intent. Don't have to worry about that, but you've got to get over that barrier of getting the legal documents done.
Hey, so you've got data going back to 1992. Have you seen any kind of changes longitudinally over, you know, almost generationally now, since it's almost 30 years since the first data set?
Yeah. So some really big changes. One is that the propensity among those age 50 and above to include charity has gone up every year. It goes up, 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 up in their estate plan. So that's all encouraging. Why is that? Very simple. It's explained by two demographic factors. There is a dramatically increasing proportion of childlessness and an increasing amount of education among the 50 and above population. Now, this is really important because it not only explains why the propensity to include charity among those who have estate planning documents has gone up, but it tells us what's coming next, right? We've all heard about the baby boom. We all know the aging population, and there's going to be more and more people over age 50. But the important thing when it comes to charitable estate planning is not just that this population is going to be big, but this population is going to have a much higher propensity to include charity in the estate plan than in previous generations. Why? because they're much more likely to be childless and they're much more highly educated. Both of those things demographically, statistically drive the propensity to include charity in an estate plan. So this this baby boom is going to boom even bigger when it comes to charity. Now, having said that, there's a huge misunderstanding about that boom. The misunderstanding is when it happens. Look, the reality is that the actual dollars being transferred to charity, that happens in the very late 80s. Why is that? It's because wealthy people live longer. And in fact, wealthy people with a charitable estate component, they actually live longer than others of their same wealth category. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that charities tend to get, they will, say if you've got a group of donors, the age at which you will have gotten 50% of the charitable estate dollars from that group of donors is right around age 89. Okay, you're still going to get another half after age 89. Okay, that's a very old age. Now, recognizing that means that these baby boomers, they're way too young right now to be making much in the way of these charitable estate transfers. We are actually at the very bottom of the baby bust when it comes to this late 80s age group. And so consequently, we haven't seen the charities being flooded with these dollars from charitable estates. It's because the demographics don't say that they ought to be yet. Now, from this point forward, everything's just up, up, up. But that's because the age at which the charities actually get the dollars is a very old age. And then the final thing to keep in mind is that we just see fewer and fewer people with these documents as time goes on. Now, it may be that people are just adding transfer on death, pay on death designations to their bank accounts. In most states west of the Mississippi, you can do that with real estate now. And so maybe they're planning by alternate means, but the documents certainly are much less common than they were before. And so that is sort of the bad news along with the good news that we have an increasing propensity to include charity among those who have documents.
No, great. Russell, thanks so much for your time today. It was a really interesting discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Russell James for joining us. He's a professor at Texas Tech University where he runs the graduate program in charitable financial planning. His paper is called The Emerging Potential of Longitudinal Empirical Research in Estate Planning, Examples from Charitable Bequests.
That's our episode for today. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share the fresh research link on Twitter or Facebook to be eligible to win something from the NPT Library. You can also share on social media with the hashtag #FreshResearch. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times, spotlighting research and trends in the philanthropic sector. Till next time, keep up with us at thenonprofittimes.com for all your nonprofit news.